Summertime and the living is easy. You can be, you can be thankful I'm not going to sing the sermon today. But as familiar as we may be with those words, I'm aware that summertime isn't always easy living. In fact, perhaps because of our expectation that summer should be a laid-back, reflective, joyful time, sometimes when things head the wrong direction in summer, summer can be a harder time than other times. And I know as a pastor that I have seen, and as a man now in my 50s, I've seen enough of life to know that people can be heading someplace in their lives and things are going smooth and the vision is clear and all of a sudden there's a quick turn and life kind of turns upside down. If you've lived any length of time, you've had that experience. And if you haven't had that experience, you can consider yourself blessed and take my word for it, it's going to happen. If you've been in our church for any length of time, you've probably heard my story. It was about 16 years ago, before I came to First Baptist Church, that Sue and I pastored over in a church over in New Jersey. Our family was there. And it was a fairly large church, a church that I had great aspirations for. But in the middle of just my second year of being pastor there, all of a sudden, the deacons called for a meeting. The meeting turned out that they were not happy with some of the things I was doing. And after a couple such meetings, I realized that where they wanted the church to go and where I wanted the church to go was not exactly the same. So as time progressed, there was somebody, I never knew who it was, who called for a vote of confidence, which if you've been in any parliamentary settings, you know really is a vote of no confidence. And what that meant was they wanted me out. So I thought the wise thing to do was to step out. I knew that I didn't have the full support of the deacon board, and so I decided it was time to leave. Again, if you've heard the story, you know that probably the most upsetting part of this whole thing to me was that the night that I told the deacons and the trustees, they gathered together to tell them that I was going to resign. They sent me out of the room for a few minutes, and when they invited me back in, they said, "All right, you're done tonight. We don't want you back in this church." One of the trustees said, "We don't ever want you in our pulpit again." And I left that meeting stunned. I tell you this story because that was, for me, one of those times when life was kind of going along really smooth, and I had great plans for the future. And all of a sudden, in the course of literally about 2 or 3 months, our world as a family got turned upside down. I remember leaving that meeting, as I've shared with some of you, I'm just not sure what the future would be. I remember thinking, how in the world are we going to make ends meet? Carrie was in first grade at the time, and I thought, I can't just pull him out of school. This was in October. I really didn't know what we were going to do. And all I remember after that meeting was just come before God and saying, "God, I don't know how we're going to make it." I mean, I knew we could move in with Sue's family or my family. We had a lot more resources than some people that I have tried to help in the past. But I really didn't know what was going to happen in the future. My suspicions are that your stories are quite a bit different than mine, but you've had stories like that, where all of a sudden you're moving along the road and life takes a turn, and all of a sudden, you're upside down, and things aren't going the way you thought they should be. I've been pastor long enough, I've lived long enough to see it in many of your lives. Seen people face death, unexpected death, that totally change all the circumstances for your family. I've seen marriages go on the rocks and how the heartbreak that that has brought. I've seen people lose jobs and face cancer, and all in this congregation. And so I know that you know what it is to have life turn upside down on you. What do you do? What do you do when life takes one of those turns? Well, this morning, I want to share with you the words of David. We're going through this series, the Summer in the Psalms. But to appreciate David's words, you have to know a little bit about David's life. But I invite you to turn in your Bibles to Psalm chapter 3, or Psalm 3. It's not a chapter, it's a psalm. And before we even open the psalm, after you read the number of the psalm, Psalm 3, in most of your Bibles, there's a superscription. That is, it's not a verse, it's a little bit of a background about the psalm. And in over 70 of the psalms that are attributed to David in the psalms, there's a superscription like this that tells us something about the circumstances that prompted this psalm. So in this particular case, it says, a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. Now, some of you are familiar with that story of David and Absalom. We talked about it briefly on Father's Day. But to appreciate this psalm, I think you have to understand how David's life had been turned upside down. You see, David, when you read through 1 and 2 Samuel, you discover that David has gone from a shepherd boy to the king of Israel. And the road there, as many of you know, was not an easy road for him. Because as a shepherd boy, he wasn't expected to be anything but a shepherd. But God had picked him out to be the next king. And when the current king, Saul, heard about that, he was not happy. He was very threatened by David. And so for many years of David's life as a young man, he ran as persona non grata, enemy number one of the king. Saul wanted to eliminate David. But that has gone by, and David has become the king. And not only has he become the king, but he has expanded the territory of Israel so that it is at its zenith. And David is at his zenith in chapters 8, 9, and 10 of 2 Samuel. Everything is going well for David. He's winning battles. He's solving problems. He demonstrates his heart after God. And then all of a sudden, in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, we discover that life takes a detour. The first verse of 2 Samuel 11 tells us that at a time when kings go out to war, David sent Joab. There is a hint in that, though nothing said directly, that David should not have stayed home. But he did. It was a time when he should have been out with the troops, but he sent his commander, second in command. Whether David had bad intentions by staying home or whether he just opened himself to temptation, all we know was at that point in time, David's life takes a detour because of the choices that David made. Again, if you know the story, you know that David stayed home. And like a lecherous old man, he's up on the top of the palace and he's looking out, and there's a woman who is bathing. And he just continues to stare. I guess thinking he's king, he is entitled to whatever he wants, and he decides that he wants this woman and discovers her name is Bathsheba. He invites her quietly to the palace and they have a clandestine relationship. I don't know if it was a one-night affair or something that went on for a number of weeks. We're not told. All we know is that through that relationship to a married woman, she became pregnant. The reason her husband was not around, if you're not familiar with the story, is he was a soldier in David's army. He was out serving God and country, and while he was away, David was playing with his wife. But things went from bad to worse when David one day received a note. It said, "I'm pregnant, signed B." I don't know if that's how she communicated, but somehow she told him. And as David thought about what he had done, his initial reaction was not, "Oh boy, I should repent of this." It's, "How am I going to cover it up?" So if you remember the story, you remember that initially he invites Uriah back from battle to try to get him to sleep with his wife, but Uriah wants to be true to his fellow soldiers who wouldn't be with their wives, and he refused to sleep with his wife. So when David realized that he couldn't make Uriah look like the father, he had a different plan. He sent Uriah back to battle with a note to be given to his general. "Leave him at the wall where he'll be vulnerable." David was plotting Uriah's death. And so David indirectly murdered Uriah to cover up this crime that he had done. And as soon as Uriah was removed from the picture, he marries Bathsheba. And in a short while, they have a child. Now, David thought he'd covered it all up. He thought it was something that maybe only the people who were closest to him would have any inkling about, and they wouldn't talk. But the servants obviously knew. They had seen Bathsheba come to the palace in those weird times. They suspected something was going on. Worse than that, David's older children must have known. They wondered, why in the world would David suddenly marry a dead man's widow? The older children, they knew how to count, and they knew how long it took to make a baby, and they realized this baby came awfully fast. And so if they had suspicions, they were confirmed when this child came along. David's children knew. And of course, God knew. And a great verse of understatement, Samuel says, what David did displeased the Lord. So God sent the prophet Nathan to speak to David and told David that because of what you've done, there will be consequences. And it wasn't simply consequences that God was out to zap David. There's really not, that's how people may interpret it, but when you think about it, the consequences of what David had done were sown with his family. The consequences of what David had done were his own undoing, not necessarily God's. And the first thing that happened to David was, as soon as Nathan got home, David got word that his little baby, the product of he and Bathsheba, was very ill. And David cried out to God, and I'm sure he confessed his failure and his sin and said, "Lord, this one's on me. Let me die, not this baby." But nevertheless, the baby died. And if David thought that his suffering would end when this child died, his struggles were just starting to begin. Because as time went by, we see the unraveling of David's family. We see David's life get turned completely upside down. In the chapters that follow in 2 Samuel, I think it begins in chapter 12, we discover that David's children, who have seen David's behavior, really demonstrate that the apple hasn't fallen too far from the tree. One of David's sons had a half-sister by another wife of David. Her name was Tamar. And this son, his name was Amnon, and Amnon found himself much like his father, irresistibly attracted to this woman. He couldn't keep his eyes off of her, couldn't keep his thoughts off of her. He had to have her. And even though she was his half-sister, he plotted how he could get her to be with him. He feigned like he was ill, and he lay in bed and pretended that he needed to be cared for and nursed, and lured Tamar into his room and sent everyone out of the room. And then when the room was empty and the doors were locked, he forcibly raped his half-sister. We're told that when that incident was done, all of a sudden he hated his sister. He didn't want anything to do with her. Well, this didn't sit well with Tamar's full brother, Amnon's half-brother, Absalom. Absalom hated Amnon for what he did to his sister. David, we're told, was angry. But David didn't do anything about it. I suspect that David didn't do anything because he felt he couldn't do anything. I mean, what moral ground did he have? In a moment of weakness, he had given into his passions. Anyway, as David kind of sat by idly, Absalom plotted how he could get even with Amnon. It took a couple years, but finally Absalom called a meeting of the sons of David. All of them were gathered together, and Absalom, he'd learned well as a son. Just as David had instructed people how to take care of Uriah, Absalom told some of his people how to get rid of Amnon, and they murdered him in front of all the other king's sons. And so all of a sudden, Absalom becomes a fugitive. He's been responsible for the death of his brother, and everybody knows it. David knows it. And so Absalom flees. And even though David loved Absalom, obviously his actions ripped David's heart apart. In time, Joab was able, because he saw how conflicted David was over the absence of his son, and Joab, David's general, persuaded David to invite Absalom back from exile. And so Absalom moved back to Jerusalem, and he lived in Jerusalem for 2 years, but had no interaction with his dad. It was a dysfunctional relationship. David loved his son, and yet he didn't know how to love his son. And Absalom, in the whole fracture of all of that, and his bitterness and his anger, decided that he would take over the kingdom. And so Absalom, who was a very charismatic young man, very attractive and had people following him, he devised a plan. And over time, he would tell the people, he would hear cases and do whatever he could do as king's son. And he would basically tell people what they wanted to hear to get them on his side. And soon enough, in a few years' time, there were more people loyal to Absalom than to the distant King David. And that's when Absalom decided to take over. So as the story unfolds in 2 Samuel, we get to 2 Samuel chapter 15. David is now being forced out. He could fight. He could go to battle against his son, but he didn't want to do that. He doesn't want to hurt Absalom. So he decides he would just sneak out of town. And if you keep your fingers in Psalm 3 and you look over to 2 Samuel 15, you discover this point in time that I think is reflected in this psalm in 2 Samuel 15. David is slinking out from the palace on Mount Zion. He's leaving Jerusalem, going through the Kidron Valley, and on the other side of the Kidron Valley is the Mount of Olives. And it says in verse 23, because this was not only the fracture of a family, it was the fracture of a nation. The whole countryside wept aloud as the people passed by. The king also crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the people moved on toward the desert. Zadok, who was a priest, was there too, and all the Levites who were with him were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. They set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar offered sacrifices until all the people had finished leaving the city. And then David said to Zadok, "Take the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says, 'I am not pleased with you,' then I am ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him." Do you see the sadness in those words? David has messed up his life royally. As a king, he has been a royal failure. And he's not only messed up his life, but he's messed up his family's life. And in messing up his family's life, he's messed up the life of the nation. And it's a public disgrace, this secret sin that David committed. And now, the priests want to bring the ark with David. David realizes what a sinner he is. I think by this time he has found forgiveness with God. I don't doubt that. But he's very much conflicted. And he realizes that to have the ark is to somehow to have God's favor. And he says, just leave the ark in Jerusalem. That's where it belongs. And if somehow God can use me, somehow he can make good out of this, he will. It's a sad moment in David's life. A moment of realized failure. A moment of grief, of guilt. And that's where we find David. And yet, this psalm, which was penned from all of this, is not a psalm of failure. It's a psalm of hope. So how did David get from this place where he's been exiled from his own kingdom to a place of hope? Well, one other thing that's worth noting before we leave 2 Samuel 15, it says at the end of the chapter, beginning of verse 32, it says, when David arrived at the summit, well, actually, let me have you look at verse 30. Because this also is pictured in the psalm. But David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head is covered, and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too, and they were weeping when they went up. David is weeping because he's been forced into exile, but he's weeping because he's lost his son. He's weeping because his life has fallen apart. But in verse 32, it says, when David arrived at the summit, he's gone up, down from Mount Zion, from Jerusalem, down into the Kidron Valley. Now he's going back up on the other side of the Mount of Olives. When he arrived at the summit, where the people used to worship God, Hushai the Archite was there to meet him. His robe was torn and dust on his head. And in the next verses, David goes on to tell him, I want you to go back to Jerusalem. And I want you to be kind of my inside man in Jerusalem. Absalom will trust you, and you can relay to us kind of as my spy what's going on. So even in the midst of all that is going on, David hasn't become totally passive. There's a little seed that he's planted, something that we'll learn later on God used. But what did David do to turn this hopeless situation into something of hope? Because again, this psalm was inspired by this situation. Now, we don't know exactly when David penned Psalm 3. We don't know if it was on his way up to the Mount of Olives. We don't know if it was when he was in the Mount of Olives. We don't know if it was after this whole situation was done. But as you read the psalm, it kind of pictures us in the middle of this. And I can't help but think, even though it's just pure conjecture on my part, that David may have written this psalm after he went up to the Mount of Olives. He's been crying, weeping in grief, bemoaning his failures, his broken family. But there's a change that takes place in David's life, and it's reflected in this psalm. So, what do you do? What did David do when his world was turned upside down? Well, the shortest answer I can tell you is you pray. This psalm, Psalm 3, really is a prayer to God. In fact, Psalm 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 are all prayers to God. And that's one of the reasons they're grouped together. And this is a prayer we discover that's a prayer in the morning. He says in verse 5, I lay down and sleep, and I wake up again because the Lord sustains me. So he may have prayed this prayer when he woke up. And Psalm 4 is a prayer in the evening. He prays as he goes to bed. And that's why these two psalms have been put where they are, back to back, a morning prayer and an evening prayer. And so as David faces the circumstances in his life, what he does is he prays. And you could also say that he sings, because this psalm, while it apparently began as a prayer that David put down in his diary, is also a song. We know that for a couple reasons. Just that the word psalm that is used here is a word that speaks of a song. And then this word Selah that you see at the end of these different verses. Verse 3 ends with the word Selah, and verse 4 ends with the same word, and verse 8. Commentators, scholars, Bible scholars don't really know what the word means, but what they are pretty confident of is that it's a musical term. And that somehow it gives some instruction when this is used musically, maybe as a pause or maybe a place where instruments would be louder. We just don't know. But this prayer is also a song. And as David prays, he begins by just honestly stating his situation. But the most important aspect of this prayer is the opening word, oh God. Two words, I guess. In Hebrew, it's just God. How many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. In that circumstance, you can understand why people, even people in Israel, would question whether God would deliver David. In fact, I can very much relate to Psalm 3 in my own life, because I believe that God can do, I believe God is all powerful. I believe God can do whatever he wants to do. Where I struggle the most is when I put myself in circumstances by my own stupid choices or sinful choices or rebellious choices that I know that I've estranged myself from God, and I confess my sin to God, and I get right with God, but I still realize there are consequences to the choices I've made. Can I still cry out to God and ask for his help when I've put myself in this situation? I can't help but think, it doesn't say this here, but I can't help but think that's part of what David's wrestling with. He's not only dealing with those of his son Absalom, who, as they've turned their backs on David, they've turned their backs on David's God, and they assume that God's no longer fighting for David. We can take over. Nothing's going to happen. But I can't help but think that for David, he also had the temptation to think, can God get me out of this mess? I mean, I put myself into it. Anyway, that's how the prayer begins, and it's the most important part of the prayer, is just who it's addressed to. And then it's just an honest assessment of the situation. How many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. I've often told people, it doesn't do us any good in our prayers to not be honest with God. I mean, he knows our hearts better than we know our own hearts. So we might as well just tell him. Tell him the circumstances, tell him our doubts, just lay it out honestly before him. And that's where this prayer begins. Looking to God and explaining the situation. But early on, this prayer turns, and this is the hope of this prayer in verses 3 and 4. But you, God, are a shield about me. You bestow glory on me and lift up my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers from his holy hill. Remember that picture of David as he is down the bottom of the Kidron Valley, or maybe on his way up the Mount of Olives, and he's weeping, and his head is covered, and he's shamed, and he's discouraged, and he's defeated, because he's overwhelmed by what he has done and overwhelmed by the circumstances that face him. And yet as he comes before God, he's no longer looking at his circumstances. He's looking at God. He's seeing what God can do. And all of a sudden, everything has changed. The circumstances are the same. Nothing has happened physically that's any different, but inside there's been a change, because no longer is David consumed by all the circumstances that have brought him to this point. He's focused on God. And this prayer helps him to see the God who is capable of meeting his every need, of delivering him. And when we face those circumstances in our lives where it's beyond our control and we can't do anything, we just say, God, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how we're going to get out of this. I don't know how we're going to provide for our family. I don't know what's going to happen here. That's a good place to be. Acknowledging your need before the Almighty God. And having done that, David has peace. He says, I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. It's important to note here that as you get to verses 5 and 6, when David expresses his confidence and his peace, nothing has happened yet. Absalom is still up there in Jerusalem taking over. He's still after David. And the circumstances have not resolved themselves. It still looks ominous, but David's attitude has changed. Because instead of looking at the circumstances surrounding him, he's looking up at God. And he realizes, I don't have control. I've blown it. My life is a mess. My family's a mess. There's nothing I can do. But the one person who can do something is the person to whom I'm praying. God, I need you. And the message of this psalm is, if we have complete confidence in the God who has committed himself to us, then we can have peace even when our world is turned upside down. David knew that God had made a commitment to him. When Nathan had confronted him and David admitted his sin, Nathan said that God would continue his covenant with David despite his sin. God's commitment is always ongoing. He's committed himself to us, and we know that he's committed himself to us, because if you know Jesus Christ as your Savior, you know that God, who took you and me when we were enemies of him and sent his Son to die in our place, to to give us the opportunity to have a relationship with Him, if He would do that for us, we can know that there's nothing that's going to separate us from God's love. And that's why David had the peace that he had. And so he prays, "Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked." This is David the king who is praying this against those enemies who were not just enemies of his, but enemies of his God. Bruce Waltke, who wrote a commentary on the Psalms, said this is not a prayer for us as Christians. It was a prayer for David as a king, but there are several different places in the Psalms. They're called imprecatory Psalms, where David calls on God's vengeance upon his enemies. We know that God ultimately will do what is right and what is just, and we know that ultimately the wicked will be destroyed, but that's not our responsibility, that's His responsibility. And we can entrust those who might oppose us to God. But the bottom line is, David asks God to act, the one in whom he has his trust. And out of that, he says, "From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be upon your people." That's the message of this psalm. If we put our complete trust in the God who has committed himself to us, we can have peace. We can have confidence that he will do what's right. And I can tell you, for those who haven't heard our story, that we learned that firsthand in our situation in New Jersey. And the part of that that was almost comically interesting to me is when I went back to the chairman of the deacon board and the chairman of the trustees after they had told me that we were done, they offered us that we could stay in the parsonage for 6 months, and they offered to continue to pay my salary for 6 months. And when 6 months was done, that was April, and our son Kerry still had 3 months left of school, and we hadn't found a church. By that time, I had come to this church, and there was some possibilities, but we hadn't found a church. And so I went to the deacon board chairman, the trustee board chairman. I said, can we stay in the parsonage for 3 more months until school is out? I knew they didn't have another pastoral candidate on the horizon. And they said, "Well, we need some time to think about this." And I actually went to them in March, and it took them a month to sort it out. And finally, they called me at the end of March, and I sat down with these two men, and they said, "We don't want you staying in the parsonage, but we don't like the reputation it will give our church if we kick you out on the street. And so we've decided to let you stay here through the end of June, rent-free. Now, I have noted this numerous times. They didn't have to say that. I mean, they could have just sounded magnanimous, whether they felt magnanimous or not, and they could have said, "Of course you can stay here." But they made it clear that this was not really their desire. But as close to a voice from God as I've had in my life, as I walked out of that meeting, I felt this sense, "Tori, even if they don't take care of you, I will." And that's what God can do for us. When your life is turned upside down and you don't know where to turn, what to do, do what David did. Just cry out to God. Tell him what's going on in your life and call upon the covenant-keeping God to take care of you. You can count on him to do that.